In no particular order, we will do immigration and inflation, banks and the debt limit. Never fear, though, we'll make it interesting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 12th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are just going to dig right in. A bunch of stuff to talk about. Probably not as much time as we need. Jordan Holman's at the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you. We will start with inflation, and we will point out that both the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and the PPI, the Producer Price Index, came out this week. Elevated, but trending down. Discuss.
Better. Still not good enough. This is the challenge that we have with inflation. It's, you look at any chart, and it's just like, it's got the downtrend, but we've been dealing with this for 2 years now. So what do you do after 2 years? Do you just think, oh, we can wait two more years? Well, no, not if you're at the Federal Reserve. You've got to deal with that immediately. You cannot let this stuff get entrenched and let people think that you're going to have 4% or 5% or even 3% inflation. So you got to stay at least at where you are. But, you know, there are a lot of other things happening in the economy. So maybe this will actually improve faster than expected.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of those other things, Jordan, because Sabri did a story for us earlier this week on consumers and how consumers getting tired. So put on your retail reporter hat for me, and we'll get to the big picture retail in a minute. But I want your sense with consumer sentiment out this morning showing the lowest reading in 6 months. People are worried about inflation expectations. They're worried about 6 months from now. How much longer can consumers continue to drive this economy? I know I ask you this all the time. I apologize about that.
No, it makes sense. I mean, I feel like the headlines are finally getting to consumers. Like, we've seen a lot about the debt ceiling earlier this spring. It was about banks. Like, that's finally seeping into people's psyche, and then obviously the elevated inflation. And it's not a case of people aren't spending, but they're spending where they want to, and they're pulling back in other areas, which is then making retailers have to navigate that world. But it does finally feel like this consumer sentiment's a leading indicator. So it's like, maybe this is a breaking point in some ways.
How are spending habits changing, Jordan? Can you tell us that?
Yeah. So Walmart, so the largest retailer in the U.S., they have been really clear over the past few quarters saying that shoppers with an income of 100K are actually coming to Walmart more. So that's indicating that even if people do have money to spend at other places, they want to conserve their spending when it comes to food or clothes or whatnot. And so people are making those choices, but we're still seeing people spend on concert tickets and travel and whatnot.
Right. Sudeep, one more indicator for you. Jobless claims. First time jobless claims were elevated this week. You know, the highest they've been in a bit. So the labor market is slowing. Inflation is coming down. I'm going to say two words and then I want your reaction. Those two words are soft and landing.
Possible. Still possible. It's still within the realm of possible that this won't all blow up on us. We've been waiting for jobless claims to increase. We'll see whether this was a one-week fluke. There are always measurement issues, and there might have been some issues in Massachusetts. But yeah, there's a little bit of that. But we've been waiting for kind of a slowing of the labor market. We haven't seen that. That is what a soft landing looks like. Slowing of job growth, a slowing of wage growth. Instead, we have other things that are going to be driving embedded inflation, and that it all comes together at that stage. If you can keep moderate job growth, then you can keep consumers spending. If you can keep inflation coming down a little bit, then you don't have to have a big battle at the Fed over whether to whack the economy even more. Leave that to the United States Congress.
Well, all right, hold on, because we're going to get there. You hold that thought. Jordan, I do want to roll everything we have said so far up into a big ball and toss it to you with this. Banks are getting ready for the debt limit not to resolve itself or to be resolved. They are also worried about inflation and consumers. I wonder what big retailers are doing. Do you have a sense of how nervous they are about everything right now, the uncertainty?
So this coming week is a major week for retail earnings. So we'll hear from Walmart, Target, Home Depot. And I think the story there is they know that there's going to be a slowdown in consumer spending, which is what we've talked about. And it's just about how smart they're being with inventory and kind of setting themselves up for it. So it's more of a question of like how much spending has slowed down. And then you have the bigger macro congressional things happening. Mm-hmm. So right now, major retailers are having to play defense, where over the past few years, it's been like people are going to walk into the store, they're spending, all of that kind of stuff. We're definitely in a different situation now.
Hmm. All right, Sudeep, the elephant in the room, as it were, the Congress, Republicans in the House are not interested in raising the debt limit clean. There are supposed to be some negotiations happening, staff talks. I do wonder, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said this morning, got a default on something. You can't pay all my bills. What am I supposed to do? And I guess the question is, you know, you earlier had been pretty steadfast that there was going to be a solution. And I wonder if you still are.
I still think there's going to be a solution. There are really only two options in my mind. Does this require a minor market freakout, or does it require a major market freakout? That a minor market freakout and a solution keeps the soft landing alive. A major market freakout and the solution is it's not quite the Armageddon of a default, but it's not good. You don't want to go down this with another United States credit rating downgrade. You don't want to go down this by creating the problems in the job market. That is obviously the mess. But a minor market freakout is what Washington usually needs to get these things done. And Janet Yellen is right. But when the Treasury Secretary is asking which bills do you want me to default on, the debt or everything else, you're not in a great situation as a country.
Yeah, no, you're not. All right, Sudeep, 30 seconds on this last answer. There are Republicans in the House, in Kevin McCarthy's caucus, who say they are interested in defaulting. Do you actually believe that they mean that?
They do not understand what it means. So once they understood what it means, they will not actually be interested in it. But it's a talking point for now to hold your position. And then once they see their 401ks get whacked and all their constituents angry at them, it'll be a different story then.
Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Jordan Holman at the New York Times on a Friday. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a great weekend. Wall Street Today, traders tried, but could not quite get back to neutral. We'll have the details. No freak out, by the way, on Wall Street today when we do the numbers. When exactly that X date that Sudeep and Jordan and I were talking about is going to hit, when Janet Yellen's going to be fresh out of all her extraordinary measures, is still kind of up in the air. It all depends on tax receipts coming in, how much and how soon. But while the Internal Revenue Service keeps an eye on its inbox, there is one thing it needs not worry about this year, not so much anyway, refunds. It's not really going to make an X date difference, but so far the IRS says the average refund is down more than 7% from last year, and an overall decline of nearly $23 billion. Marketplace's Henry Epp has that one.
Last year, pandemic relief was still boosting tax refunds, says Francine Lipman, a professor of law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
During 2021, Congress really put their hand into their pocketbooks and generated significant tax relief.
Refunds paid in 2022 were still loaded with economic impact payments and the expanded child and earned income tax credits. Now all of that's gone.
These benefits expired, and so the old provisions then were resurrected.
Fewer Americans have filed tax returns this year. Janet Holzblatt, a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, says that's because those temporary benefits prompted more people to file during the pandemic.
And I think that's indicative of the fact that people became eligible for credits that they normally would not have gotten, that normally their income would have been too low.
Smaller tax refunds and fewer people getting them mean less spending power for consumers. That might be good news for Jay Powell and the Fed as they look to cool the economy, but it's not great for households, says Mark Stieber with Jackson Hewitt Tax Service.
It certainly doesn't make for a good experience at the dinner table when you're talking with your family about what we're needing to do and spend this year.
The book on 2023 refunds isn't fully written yet. People feeling the effects of last year's severe weather have extra time to file, some until mid-October. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Shares of PacWest Bancorp lost another 3% today. They're down better than 50% in the past month, 50%, the latest of the regional banks to find itself under pressure as depositors take counsel of their fears and pull their money out. Deposits at federally insured banks are, as we all know by now, covered up to $250,000. The catch, of course, is that the money for that insurance coverage has to come from somewhere, and whence it comes is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, whose fund to cover those losses has taken a hit of almost $16 billion the past couple of months. Now, and this is by law, the FDIC now has to top that fund up, and it does have a plan. A proposed rule out earlier this week calls for a special assessment on the country's biggest banks. But a proposed rule is just that, a proposal. The banks get to weigh in, too, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
The FDIC said the proposed fee will only affect 113 banks, but it didn't say which ones. Betsy Johnson is chair of the Illinois Bankers Association and president of Solutions Bank in Forreston, Illinois. Today, she and her colleagues were still sorting out the details.
I'd be honest with you, we're still diving through this, digesting what it actually really means and the impact of what it has. There's always implications to everything and sometimes unintended consequences.
The special assessment of 0.125% would only apply to banks with assets over $5 billion, with the vast majority of the fees paid by banks with assets over $50 billion. Carlos Naudan is president and CEO of Ponce Bank in New York and says those thresholds are the result of a lot of lobbying by smaller banks.
We were able to see to it that FDIC took a more reasonable approach to the special assessment.
He's pretty sure his bank wouldn't be required to pay the fee, but knows that could change depending on what happens in the 60-day comment period. So he's headed to Washington next week to do some in-person lobbying of his own, even as he continues to have conversations with his customers to assure them his bank is still a safe place for their money. Assurances many of the bankers I've spoken to say are working.
The depositors, they have calmed down, I think.
Amiatosh Punanandam teaches finance at the University of Michigan, but he says stockholders are another story. While people with uninsured deposits can look to the FDIC for comfort,
stockholders are going to continue to freak out because there's no bailout happening for the stockholders.
The FDIC isn't coming to save them. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
By all accounts, the scene at the southwest border a day after the expiration of those Title 42 immigration restrictions is crowded but not chaotic. It is getting a lot of attention, of course, from immigration policy watchers and political types, corporate types too, because as much as migration is a labor market story, it's also a business opportunity. And you'd best believe private prison companies with government contracts are paying oh-so-close attention. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has that story.
In recent earnings calls of private prison companies, Geo Group and Core Civic, the conversation on the charged topic of immigration is, well, dry. Corporate.
The scheduled expiration of Title 42 restrictions at the southwest border could provide upside to our current forecast.
That's George Zoli, CEO of Geo Group.
It's an unpredictable situation, I think, for all of us.
Title 42 is brought up again and again in the call, which makes sense. The company earned $2.4 billion in revenue last year, much of it from contracts with ICE for detention beds and ankle monitoring. Core Civic has staffed up for a migrant influx. Here's CEO Damon Heininger from his company's earnings call.
Having staffing in places, especially under ICE contracts, at an elevated level for potential demand is a good investment.
And immigration detention contracts are critical for business since they're excluded from the Biden administration's executive order to end private prison contracts. Eunice Cho is with the ACLU's National Prison Project.
Private prison companies have been able to continue profiting from their contracts with the government for the detention of people in immigration detention.
ICE's budget for detention beds this year is $1.4 billion. I'm Elizabeth Troval for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They just hold it and give it back to you when you want it.
Seems simple enough, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials was off 8 points. We'll call that flat, 33,300. The NASDAQ dipped 43 points, 0.3%, 12,284. The S&P 500 slid 6 points, about a 0.1%, 41.24 there. For the week, the Dow was almost flat, down less than a 0.1%. The NASDAQ down 0.3%. S&P 500 also ticked down about a 0.1%. Peloton is recalling more than 2 million exercise bikes due to faulty seat posts. That is just on the heels of the fitness company reporting losses last quarter. Investors, however, did not seem to be bothered today. Peloton shares sped up 0.1%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. One cannot know whether the worst of the banking challenges we have been seeing are behind us. But I think we're all more aware now than we had been that the way most banks do business is not without risk. They take deposits that their customers can withdraw whenever they want, but banks use those deposits to make loans, sometimes long-term loans, which means they might not actually have depositors' money on hand when said depositors come to withdraw, which, can be a problem if a whole lot of customers start asking for their money all at once. There is an alternative approach to banking that, in theory, could help banks avoid those kinds of problems altogether, though. It's called narrow banking, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Narrow banking is a pretty simple idea. Banks take in depositors' money, but instead of lending it out,
they hold it. They just hold it and give it back to you when you want it.
That's Julie Hill, a law professor at the University of Alabama. She says a narrow bank could just lock your money away in a vault behind the tellers, but more likely it would find a boring investment to park it in.
They could hold it, in theory, at the Federal Reserve. That's a lot like holding it in a vault, but could potentially earn some interest on it. Or they could invest it in government treasuries.
That means that a narrow bank couldn't fail, since it could always pay back its customers, at least as long as the U.S. government doesn't default. But holding on to those assets, instead of lending out the money the bank put into them, is not very profitable.
If all you're doing is investing in very, very safe products, it's hard to generate revenue.
For a lot of U.S. history, banks were actually pretty narrow. Before the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation came along in the 1930s, banks didn't have much protection if a bunch of depositors barged in and demanded their money all at once, like they did at the Bailey Building and Loan in It's a Wonderful Life.
I'll take mine now.
No, but you're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here.
George Pinaki, a finance professor at the University of Illinois, says banks faced a lot of runs back then. So?
They had to maintain a good proportion of their assets in very short-term loans and relatively safe securities.
Pinaki says the creation of the FDIC and the Federal Reserve gave banks a backstop, so they didn't have to worry as much about runs.
So they essentially could lengthen the maturity of their loans and make riskier loans.
And make more money. So since then, banks have become a lot less narrow.
In the conventional commercial banking system, there's not a whole lot of incentive for banks to operate this way.
Some banks are trying to change that. In 2017, James McAndrews founded a company literally called The Narrow Bank. It doesn't make loans, and it doesn't work with regular retail depositors. Instead, it targets big institutional clients, pension funds, and large corporations. They have a lot of cash that wouldn't be covered by the FDIC.
these are the investors that are most flighty, most prone to run. They must run if they wish to keep their funds safe.
The narrow bank would keep their money safe by parking it in an account with the New York Federal Reserve.
TNB would then receive interest on the funds in its account at the Federal Reserve and remit much of this interest to the depositor.
Problem is, the New York Fed hasn't allowed the narrow bank to open an account, so the bank's been sitting dormant for almost 6 years. The New York Fed didn't comment. The Fed's Board of Governors has said it has a few concerns about narrow banking. One of them, by luring deposits away from conventional banks, which make loans with deposits, narrow banks could make business loans harder to get and more expensive. Frederick Mishkin, a banking professor at Columbia Business School, says businesses would turn to non-bank lenders.
And if that's not regulated well, and there are mistakes made, you could get blowups that could be even more severe.
Mishkin says we want banks to make loans, in large part because they're pretty good at figuring out which borrowers are creditworthy.
Part of their business model is that they actually have deposits of the persons they lend to. So they can actually get information as to whether that firm is doing well, whether they're taking on too much risk and so forth, which gives them an inherent advantage in figuring out whether they're a good credit risk or not.
Mishkin says there's a place for narrow banks, but they're not guaranteed to prevent the next financial crisis. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We are all going to spend in total this year more than $550 billion on recreation. The peak in the before times, 2019, $520 billion. So there is some pent-up recreation demand. And that brings us to today's installment of our series, My Economy, because a chunk of that money, not a huge chunk, but definitely not nothing, is going to classic arcades.
My name is Jamie York. I'm the owner of Game Underground. We're a video game store slash arcade in Waltham, Massachusetts. 2020 was really tough because, it was quieter. But in my business, quiet is bad. You know what I mean? You don't want it to sound quiet. We weren't sure if we were going to go out of business or what. But, you know, we're glad that we were able to survive. You go out there right now in our store, and there's a community, and there's 20 people all over there playing video games together, face-to-face, in person. It's a huge deal now, just finally getting everything back to normal, you know what I mean? With my business, I've been very lucky to have a lot of things go my way. I personally believe just an arcade is not enough to survive anymore, unfortunately. Just a game store is really tough. It'd have to be really small. Just a land center seems really tough to me. With the video game business, a lot of stuff is moving from physical media to digital media. So arcades fell off a lot when you could buy, you know, Street Fighter 2 at your house. So, you know, trying to figure out what can I do in person that you can't get. So we got a lot of cool stuff going on. It's Fight Night tonight. The demo for Street Fighter 6 is out. Jay, how are you checking this out? You think it's good?
I think this is lit. It's so sick right now. I'm training with Luke, just getting down the schematics, but this game is phenomenal. You know, it's going to be lit.
All right. Yes. We had a basketball game here that was really hard to move in, and it worked for about a month and then broke. Eventually, one of my friends said, hey, there's another basketball game for sale on like Facebook Marketplace. So I bought a different one. And then I put the other machine for sale. I'm like, hey, it doesn't work right. You know, $1,000, come grab it. And no one did. And I was like, doesn't work right, $500. I'm like, no. I was like, okay, please come get this. And the machine like sat in the middle of our store, like where people play Magic the Gathering, and they had to like kind of climb over the machine to play games until someone eventually came and rescued it from us. Having a good dynamic and a good team with people with different skills to help you is a huge deal. Trying to get everybody's best parts and advantages to come and make a good team is kind of where we're at.
There is a lot going on in that shop, huh? Jamie York, Waltham, Mass. Game Underground is the shop. We cannot do this series without you, so take a second, would you? Let us know what's going on. You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, there are some changes coming to the Federal Reserve. The White House announced this morning that the president is going to nominate Philip Jefferson, already a member of the Fed's board, to be the vice chair. Adriana Kugler is going to take his spot. She will be the first Latina Fed governor. And Lisa Cook, who's been on the board for about a year filling a vacancy, will be nominated for a full 14-year term. Advice and consent by the Senate of the United States required, of course. All right, we are going, but here's your moment of economic context. It comes with the observation that, depending on when you hear this, time is running short. The National Retail Federation says, all told, Americans are going to spend almost $36 billion on Mother's Day this year. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.